This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. The AM 580 series Caregiving Today continues today here on the Afternoon Magazine. Today we look into caring for someone with one of the most common chronic illnesses of late life, dementia. Alzheimer's disease is the most common form of dementia affecting millions of older Americans. Three guests join us this afternoon. Joining us by telephone from Rochester, Minnesota is Dr. Ronald Peterson. He is the director of the Mayo Clinic Alzheimer's Disease Center. He is also a professor there of neurology. In addition, he is the editor-in-chief of a new book from the Mayo Clinic on Alzheimer's disease. The title of the book is Mayo Clinic on Alzheimer's Disease. The paperback guide is published by Mayo Clinic Health Information. With me this afternoon in the studio, two guests, Ginny Sims and Sandy Bergner. Sandy is a professor of nursing at the University of Illinois. She's also the facilitator for an area memory loss support group. Ginny Sims is a caregiver. Her mother was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease in 1991. Ginny is also an assistant facilitator for the memory loss support group. Listeners, as we talk, I invite you to join us. Your questions about dementia and memory impairment are welcome. And I look forward to your telephone calls. The numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Ginny, Sandy, Dr. Peterson, welcome. Thank you all very much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ginny, I want to begin with you. Your mom was living far away from you. You were living here in Champaign-Urbana. She was living in Arkansas?
Yes.
Okay. And it became clear she needed some help.
Yes.
How did you become aware of that need?
I think we were down there visiting and I believe it was somewhere in 1996, 1997, actually. And I just noticed some things, just some decision-making things that were maybe one time she was going to pick up her car at the Ford place, which is quite a long distance from our house, and she decided that to walk to the Ford place. Mm. And it was very hot. And so that was one sort of indicator. And another indicator was just sort of things around the kitchen, not being able to remember where things were, like spoons or pots and pans and that sort of thing, just general disorientation around the kitchen and also then around town in the area where we had lived for our entire lives.
Mm. So then I must have made an error in the introduction then. It sounds to me like it wasn't 1991. It was 1997, am I guessing now?
Right. Actually, she just received the diagnosis recently of Alzheimer's disease. And this in my mind, was an issue for us because she was initially diagnosed with vascular-related dementia in Arkansas. And her primary care physician was very reluctant to make this diagnosis. And my aunt, who her younger sister, had taken her to a different doctor in order to get more attention paid to the memory loss that she was experiencing. Her primary care physician tended to say things like, "Oh well, that happens to all of us. It's just a product of old age or whatever, and you know we all forget." And he kept doing that over and over and over again, and to the point that my aunt sort of interceded for my mom, and she was diagnosed initially with vascular-related dementia, as I said, and was put onto Aricept. And one thing that happened after that was also very problematic is that her primary care physician at one point interceded and said, "Oh well, we don't really need to be on the Aricept, do we?" So he decided to discontinue that, which was another big problem. And so it sort of in the course of all that, we said, you know, it's time to try to get her up here so that we can help her more in her decision-making processes and help her with her choosing physicians and that sort of thing and get things going so she can be taken care of.
Yeah, I want to bring Dr. Peterson in here into the discussion. This says a couple of things to me listening to Ginny talk about her mom and her mom's situation. number one, a diagnosis is important. And number two, that sometimes it seems that a diagnosis is difficult to get, either because a physician is reluctant to make it or is reluctant to do the tests or whatever needs to be done to make that diagnosis.
Sure. Those are good questions, Celeste. I think an accurate diagnosis is important, and I think it's important to realize also that even in 2002, the diagnosis is still a clinical judgment on the part of the physician. However, physicians are getting pretty good at making that diagnosis, yet it still does involve a certain amount of judgment and a differentiation of some forgetfulness that is seen in normal aging versus what may be the earliest signs of Alzheimer's disease. And the diagnosis is usually made on positive criteria, and by that I mean if the patient fulfills the criteria of a gradual, progressive onset of forgetfulness, then followed by other cognitive changes such as maybe reading, writing, paying attention, problem solving, and those problems become sufficiently severe to affect one's daily function, then we feel that the person most likely has dementia. Dementia is the umbrella term that that encompasses a variety of conditions, but up and away, the most common form of dementia is Alzheimer's disease, and Alzheimer's disease, again, being a degenerative disease of the brain. And what Ginny was saying is that early on, her mother had been given the diagnosis of vascular dementia or dementia due to maybe little strokes. That's another form of dementia, but not due to degeneration of the brain, but rather due to these vascular features. Generally speaking, though, that form of dementia is much, much less common than is Alzheimer's disease. So if the physician gets a good history from the patient, from the family, does an examination, maybe a few laboratory tests, perhaps a head imaging study, meaning a CT scan or an MRI scan to make sure we're not dealing with a brain tumor or strokes or hydrocephalus or something like that, then the person can be fairly confident that this is most likely a degenerative disease, and Alzheimer's disease being the most common. And it's important to make that diagnosis because certainly the family needs to know, patient needs to know, and there are treatments available. We do have medications now that can help with some of these symptoms. So it at times can be a challenging diagnosis, though, in the early stages. So when a person is a little bit forgetful, you know, if a primary care physician has been following this person for many, many years, it's a difficult diagnosis to make on a person. You don't want to label them, so to speak, prematurely, and perhaps alienate the patient to a certain degree. So sometimes people will be a little reluctant to make the early diagnosis, but I think it's important to recognize the signs early on.
Yeah, and Sandy, your work as a nurse and as a facilitator for the support group, maybe you would offer us some comments on the importance of diagnosis and early diagnosis.
I think one of the things that happens is that the word Alzheimer's in itself carries a very negative connotation, and the person who's being given this diagnosis immediately is presented with a set of kind of negative expectations that they're going to be going downhill, they're going to be losing their cognitive functioning, and they're going to be basically being put in the position where they will eventually have to be cared for. And that's very traumatic for a person to hear. It's very traumatic for a person to deal with. And in my own work, I found that depression was a lot higher right after a person received that diagnosis. They were dealing with sort of the emotional impact of that diagnosis, as well as how is this going to affect my life. So it seemed very important that they have some sort of support system very early on to really try to manage the impact that diagnosis would have for them. And that's really why we started the support group here now almost 4 years ago. There's a lot of support groups for caregivers, but there really wasn't anything for the person with the disease. And this is really the person who's having to manage those symptoms and sometimes losses on a day-to-day basis. So having some mechanism of support for them very early on seemed really essential.
Mm. Ginny, was your mom aware of the problem with her memory and how did she take the diagnosis?
She, I believe, has been aware. I know definitely that she's aware that she's having problem with her memory. And she took the diagnosis, as she does, I think, everything in her life, in stride, and just, you know, this is what's happening, and now we go ahead and carry on just the way we've always been carrying on in terms of facing life and what it deals out to us. We just keep going.
And how did you make the decision, I will care for my mother, I will move her to Champaign-Urbana, I will be her caregiver?
Well, my mom and I are very close, and I knew that, you know, in looking at the diagnosis of Alzheimer's, I knew that there may be, you know, the time for us to spend together and have good times together. I didn't know what the span of that was going to be, and I wanted to have every single ounce of that with her, and so that was an easy decision to make, to bring her here so that we could have as much time together and to have as much quality time together as we possibly could. So that's how I made the decision.
Yeah. Dr. Peterson, did you want to jump in?
Yeah, I think that the decision about where to care for a person is a very personal one, and I think that it does take into account a lot of factors, such as your own personal home life situation. Do you have young children yet in the household? What's the impact? Because the disease really affects the whole family unit in addition to the patient and maybe the closest caregiver. So it is a very personal decision, and it sounds like it was made for proper reasons in this particular situation.
Okay. Well, we have a listener waiting to talk with us on line one in Champaign. Let's talk with this caller. Good afternoon.
Thank you. I'd like to ask these good people a little question about nomenclature. Having been around for a long time, I remember that when I was young, the word Alzheimer's disease was not a word that was known, except if you looked in a neurology book or something of that sort. They usually referred to people who were older as, senile or senile dementia or something like that. Alzheimer's disease sort of popped into the public prints and stuff within the past 30 years or so. But if you look in the old medical books, Alzheimer's disease was pre-senile dementia. In other words, it was people, younger people in their 50s who had memory loss and things like that. It wasn't referred to people, I never understood it to refer to people who were 85 years old and then had memory loss. That word Alzheimer's disease wasn't used that way at that time. And I just wondered why this change. Is there a medical change, or was it just done for semantic purposes where Alzheimer's disease, the name sounds better than senile dementia, and so it's used for all types of cases which have these symptoms. So it's an odd history of the nomenclature there.
Dr. Peterson, you want to take that one?
Yes, the listener must be a medical historian, because he's exactly right on the use of the terminology. Actually, the term has been around for almost a century now. Alois Alzheimer published his first case in 1907, and in fact, his first patient was 51 years of age, and consequently, for many, many years, as the listener points out, through the medical literature, Alzheimer's disease was equivalent to pre-senile dementia. That is, under age 65, if you developed dementia, then you had Alzheimer's disease. If it was old, beyond age 65, you had dementia, senile dementia. Then studies probably in the late 60s, early 70s, looking at clinical pathologic correlations, that is, looking at the profile a person would have when they were alive and becoming cognitively impaired and demented, then they died and had an autopsy, and when looked at the brain characteristics were indistinguishable whether the patient was 80 or 60 with regard to the changes that were causing the Alzheimer's disease and the symptoms, that is, plaques and tangles in the brain. So about that time, the arbitrary distinction of age 65, pre-senile and senile, was done away with, And now the disease came to be known as a clinical picture of dementia, gradually progressive, and then when the person died, the brain had plaques and tangles, and it was called Alzheimer's disease, regardless of the age. And that's pretty much the way it is right now, although the interesting thing with regard to the pathology of the disease is that we still make some age corrections for the amount or the number of lesions in the, or abnormalities in the brain. So a person with a certain number of abnormalities in the brain, plaques and tangles at age 85, needs more of them to achieve the diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease than somebody at, say, 65, because you do see some of these changes in the brain with normal aging. But beyond that, the listener is quite right that the terminology has changed. The disease has always been there, however, and what we call Alzheimer's disease now is not a recent a flurry of new cases, but in fact it's the same disease and it's been fairly constant over the years.
Is the caller still there? Did you want to follow up?
No, that's a very good explanation. I think that's answers perfectly what I had in mind.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you for the call this afternoon. Other questions are welcome. Here are the telephone numbers. If you're listening in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. We're talking this afternoon about memory impairment, dementia, Alzheimer's disease. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Three guests are with me here this afternoon on the telephone from Minnesota, Dr. Ronald Peterson, the director of the Mayo Clinic Alzheimer's Disease Center. He's a neurologist. He's the editor-in-chief of a new book from the Mayo Clinic on Alzheimer's Disease, Mayo Clinic on Alzheimer's Disease. Sandy Bergner is with me in the studio. She and Ginny Sims are here. Sandy is a professor of nursing at the University of Illinois. She's also the facilitator for an area memory loss support group. And Ginny is a caregiver. Ginny Sims is a caregiver. Her mother was recently diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. Ginny is also an assistant facilitator for the memory loss support group here in our area. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's talk with another listener, a caller in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Hello. I would like one of the guests, maybe the doctor, to talk about the circumstances to consider when beginning a drug like Aricept. And the situation that I'm considering is this. My mother is showing many signs of dementia and has been diagnosed as probably going down that road of Alzheimer's. And the suggestion was that as long as she could take care of herself, eating, dressing, and that kind of thing, that it would be fine to not begin a drug. She's very small and has been healthy and prefers not to take medicine. And I guess my own bias would be that since there could be side effects of any medicine, as long as she can handle life on her own without something, it probably would be best not to chemically interfere. I would like some comments.
I could offer a couple of comments, and perhaps Ginny and Sandy could lend their thoughts on this from a nursing and from a caregiver perspective. I think, first of all, a correct diagnosis is most important. So you indicated that she might be heading down the road of Alzheimer's disease. I think it's worthwhile to nail that down as well as possible. Is this, in fact, Alzheimer's disease? Then the three drugs that are used most commonly that are approved by the FDA, Aricept, Exelon, and Reminil, are approved for mild to moderate Alzheimer's disease. So mild means that the person is clearly impaired functionally, but it's a very mild form with maybe just memory and some other mild difficulties. The drugs can be helpful with regard to symptomatic improvement. They're not cures, though, and it's important not to expect too much from these medications. It may be that they just stabilize the condition for a period of time. But I think your concerns about side effects are real. The medications all do have side effects which can cause some discomfort for the people. Most of them are of a gastrointestinal type, but that can be disturbing to some people. So I think it is a judgment call with regard to the degree to which the disease may compromise the person's activities of daily living versus the side effect profile.
This is Dr. Bergner, Sandy Bergner, and I agree. And I think what I have seen clinically with the patients I follow and is that basically the drug does seem to stabilize a lot of the early symptoms, and you can see where function is maintained at a level that may not be possible without some medication. And I think that's a question a lot of caregivers ask. Well, how do you know if they're better off with the drug or without? And that's a hard question to answer, because without the drug, you don't know how fast someone would progress if they are on the drug. So that's a difficult judgment call. But on the other hand, a lot of the clients I've followed have been able to maintain their function through the mild cognitive impairment stage when they've been taking some of the medications.
This is Jenny Sims. Just a little anecdotal from my own personal experience, my mom has taken all three of the drugs at different times, and is currently taking Rimonil. But a lot of people say that the person who's experiencing memory loss maybe doesn't seem to improve significantly when they take the drug. It was our experience. I alluded earlier to the fact that my mom stopped taking the Aricept for probably 6 months. And I noted a very significant change or alteration in her cognitive ability during that time. And then when we resumed taking, I think we moved to Exelon at that point. At that point, again, she began to flourish again. And I don't know that it was, you know, I'm not a scientist, but it seemed to be related to the drug, and it certainly did help.
Was the caller still there? Did you want to follow up?
No, that's fine. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks for the call. We have some other listeners waiting to talk with us. Let's go and take another call on the toll-free line. Bloomington, good afternoon.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
I'm good. I was calling to find out the doctor's views on the difference between acetylcholinesterase inhibitors and cholinesterase inhibitors, and the importance of butyrylcholinesterase inhibition as in addition to acetylcholinesterase inhibition.
Technical question with regard to the actions of these drugs. All three of these drugs operate to inhibit an enzyme in the brain that breaks down one of the chemical neurotransmitters called acetylcholine. Acetylcholine is a chemical in the brain that's very important for attention, learning, memory, and other cognitive functions. In Alzheimer's disease, especially later on in the disease, this chemical decreases its in amount, and its effectiveness on and performing these function declines. And the drugs are meant to keep the level of this chemical up for a longer period of time to keep it more active. Now, there are two enzymes, as I mentioned, that break this down, and one is acetylcholinesterase and the other is butyrylcholinesterase. And the drugs differ a bit on their activity on the two types of enzymes. And it's somewhat debatable as to whether the butyrylcholinesterase, in fact, is as efficacious in terms of augmenting the actual function of the chemical in the brain. I think one of the companies that promotes the drug that is active on both the acetylcholinesterase and butyrylcholinesterase says that is a major player. One of the other companies for one of the other drugs says that, well, it's not only the enzymes, but it's also involves the receptors that are involved in the actions of these drugs, and promotes their drug as having more activity on the nicotinic receptor as in addition to the muscarinic receptor. This all gets fairly pharmacologically technical, but I think the ultimate is that all three of these drugs probably have about the same degree of efficacy. That is, they're about equally capable of improving function a little bit and maintaining function. And clinically, I don't think most people draw much of a distinction among the three drugs. There are some minor side effect profile differences. There's administration differences of the drugs, but they're all fairly similar in their overall action.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thanks for the call. Dr. Bergner, do you want to
Jump in? Well, I was just going to add, really what happens a lot of times, it's the drug that's used is the one that's the best tolerated, the one with the best side effect profile for that particular patient or client. And so it's not, I think he's right that the drug's efficacy is much the same. It's which one is most or best tolerated for that particular person.
Yeah, and so there might be some changes along the way, as in your mom's case.
Right.
Right. Let's talk with another listener. Line 2, a toll-free call, Chicago area. Good afternoon.
Excellent program, as usual. I'd like to ask two questions more, really, but I'm going to ask two questions. One is, what can people do to counteract getting Alzheimer's? And the other is, do Alzheimer's, my understanding is Alzheimer's patients do become violent, a lot of them. Not all, but is that true?
Maybe, oh. Sandy, do you want to take a shot at
that? That's not the complete question, but...
Okay.
Is that a yes or no?
I'll certainly answer the second part of it. Maybe we can answer the first part of it together. Certainly, there are what I like to call challenging behaviors rather than behavioral problems, and because it kind of puts it in a different light. But there certainly are what we term challenging behaviors, some of which may be agitated, some of which may be aggressive behaviors that you see mostly in the middle stages of the disease. You tend to think of Alzheimer's as sort of a three-stage process. From early mild to more moderate middle and then later stages.
Yes, in later stages.
And actually, you see these more challenging or aggressive behaviors in the middle stages than you do the later stages. And often, they tend to be more agitated than what I would call violent. You see more pacing, repetitive movements. If in fact, they're in a situation which is very stressful for them, they may become somewhat aggressive, but not generally not violent. We see those in about 50-60% of the people just during the middle stages, and that varies a lot by premorbid personality. There are some personality changes, but people tend to be somewhat like they were before they had the disease. So if they tended not to be more agitated or aggressive types of people, then you would be less likely to see those. So certainly it's not a condition that you're always going to see, and certainly it doesn't always evidence itself as violence. It's often just more some mild irritation, some mild aggression.
I was wondering... my reason for asking that was because I had a family member who was, I'll just ignore that, I had a family member who was, who had manic depression. And it seemed to me that Alzheimer patients have gotten all kinds of nursing homes and different help. And the people who have manic depression, it's a very sad case. State of affairs, I would hope that I'm glad to see that Alzheimer patients are getting the help they are getting, and I would hope that it would be the same for people who have manic depression. But I would also like to know, what can we do to not get Alzheimer's?
Well, that's a big question. Let's Sandy.
The study that I like to quote the most is the Nunn study by Dr. Snowden at University of Kentucky, and he did a wonderful study where he took a group of nuns and went back to their history and then followed from their historical data they had on this group of nuns, followed them through time to look at which nuns developed dementia and which ones did not. And what he found in that study were the nuns that were more physically, intellectually active, had higher levels of intellectual functioning early in life. Those particular characteristics tended to result in lower rates of dementia later in life, or that if dementia presented itself, it was at a later age. So what we've kind of learned from these studies is that there's no absolute thing you can do to prevent the disease, but there are activities that you can do to what we call buffer the possible onset and effects of dementia early on. And those being staying intellectually, physically active, challenging yourself throughout your life, not just when you become older, but having it be kind of a lifelong prescription for activity. Do you want to add to that?
No, I agree entirely with that. The Nunn study and a few other studies have appeared in the literature recently, certainly indicating that that type of intellectual and physical activity may forestall some of the features of Alzheimer's disease. In reality, I doubt that it will ultimately prevent if one is destined to get the disease, but it may forestall and may promote a higher quality of life for a longer period of time. But the honest answer is, right now, we don't have any bona fide preventative treatments for Alzheimer's disease. And there's a great deal of research going on now as to what is the underlying cause of the disease, what's the abnormality in the brain, and can we do something about that abnormality before it develops. So there are studies going on with agents like antioxidants, such as vitamin E, vitamin C, as to whether that, in fact, may have an effect on the development of Alzheimer's disease. There are drugs that are being developed that may prevent the depositing of the protein in the brain that's thought to cause some of the damage, the amyloid protein. You may remember the vaccine study that was popularized a year or so ago with the notion that by giving vaccinations against the development of this amyloid in the brain, it was thought that we possibly could prevent this protein from being deposited and causing the damage. Unfortunately, that study, the human trial, ran into some side effects and had to be halted. But the concept of a vaccine is still perhaps viable, and so people are really working very hard at trying to develop strategies to really prevent the damage before it's done, because the feeling being that if we wait until we make the clinical diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease, it's pretty far down the road and damage has already been done in the brain.
One thing that I'd like to add to this is healthy, quote-unquote healthy people, may not be able to actually prevent the onset of Alzheimer's at this particular juncture in time. However, one thing that we can do as healthy people is to start to ensure that people are well cared for and that we as a community join together and form a sense of interconnectedness and not separate ourselves from people who may be separate from or be ostracized from society, such as people with Alzheimer's and such as people with manic depression and other kinds of illnesses, but that we start to learn a way to embrace them as a community and support them. So should I at some point in time develop Alzheimer's, that I will enjoy a community that supports me and embraces me and keeps me supported.
Yeah, I wanted to follow up on the caller's question about challenging behaviors. In the Mayo Clinic on Alzheimer's disease, something that comes through is to slow down and maybe to rethink your expectations when it comes to giving care to someone who is ill. And it seems to me, you know, many of us have two speeds, fast and faster. Any advice for slowing down and for being in the space where that person is who's agitated, something is disturbing them? How do you slow it down yourself and try and work with that situation?
This is Sandy, and I think one of the things that I try to help caregivers understand is that the person with dementia, because of the changes that are happening, the physical changes, really can't adapt themselves to the demands that are placed upon them. And caregivers don't always like to hear that, because what that means for them is that they must adapt their behavior to fit that of the person they're caring for. And that's a lot of responsibility. You're asking that caregiver to think all the time about the fact that they need to change, not the care recipient. They need to pull back if they're asking too much, if they're placing too many demands on the person they're caring for. And that's a hard thing for us to do. But it's important to remember that person really is not able to adapt their behavior to environmental demands like you and I and other people are. A lot of caregivers say to me, I know he could do it if he just tried hard enough, or I know she could do it if she just tried hard enough. And the truth is they can't. They really often can't. I mean, sometimes with the right type of prompting, people can do higher levels of self-care or whatever it is expected. But it really is up to us to adapt the environment, our demands, our pace to their abilities, to look at what they can still do and capitalize on that. But we're the ones who are going to have to adapt ultimately.
I find that at our house, I'm not known for my organizational skills, but I've had to become much more organized and to plan plenty of time to get ready for things, plenty of time to travel to things. And I, most of my our friends realize that sometimes we're late, and sometimes we're late. Because sometimes things don't go as smoothly as you would like for them to go. And so we'll be there when we get there. And I think that's important to realize that you have to not only plan for things, but you also have to allow for things that you can't plan for.
Yeah, a lot of things you can't control. And you just take a deep breath, I guess, and say, well,
here we go.
Let's talk with another listener on line 4, a caller in Danville. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My question is about insurance. Does insurance or Medicare pay for the test?
I can comment on the first part a bit, and perhaps Sandy and Ginny can add about later on down the road. Usually the initial evaluation of somebody for a dementia type problem is covered by Medicare. That is, this is a medical problem that requires an appropriate medical diagnosis. So the office evaluation and many of the tests that the physician may decide to use to look for other conditions that may be contributing are generally covered by the insurance carriers. Beyond that, you get into issues then of caring for the person, and that becomes a much different situation, and probably Sandy can comment on that.
Yeah, and actually it depends upon what the situation is, and there are so many living configurations right now that there's probably not one across the board a global answer to that. A lot of caregivers are in one setting and the person that they're caring for is in assisted living or some other kind of sheltered environment setting. Right now there's very little support for assistance in the home. There's special programs that will cover some home care on Medicare. If you're homebound and need skilled nursing care, will cover some of the in-home care. Then there are special grants for things like in-home aid care. When you get into assisted living, there really isn't Medicare support for assisted living. And that's something to consider. And then for long-term care environments, if you're discharged from the hospital to the long-term long-term care setting, there's some Medicare coverage for a certain period of time, but that's time limited. So if you're in long-term care for much longer than 6 months or so, then there are other, you're going to need other sources of resources and support for that, such as paying out of the pocket or eventually thinking about Medicaid supplement for that kind of care. The smart thing, and I think probably what a lot of people are doing at this point in time, is looking at things like long-term care insurance, which you cannot get once you have an Alzheimer's diagnosis. So it's the kind of thing you need to think about proactively. But they're really thinking about co-pays and such supplemental things as long-term care insurance to really help cover the long cost, the long-haul cost of institutional care or nursing home care.
The caller want to follow up.
Yes, I have a neighbor lady, and she was all set up for an appointment to do the Alzheimer test, and she called Medicare just to make sure, you know, they was going to pay it, and they told her no, and so she canceled.
My only comment on that would be how she phrased the Alzheimer's tests.
Okay.
That is, there are some laboratory tests that are being promoted by some commercial laboratories as being Alzheimer's tests. For example, there's a spinal fluid. If you do a lumbar puncture and get some spinal fluid and send the spinal fluid off to a laboratory, they can tell you some levels of some chemicals in the spinal fluid that help you make the diagnosis. They're rather expensive tests. They're not definitive tests. And consequently, many third-party payers will not cover that. However, I think if you were to rephrase that is, can the person go for an evaluation by the doctor for this, I think that would be covered as a general medical evaluation for a dementia or a memory problem. So it may be in the way the question was phrased to Medicare.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. And I want to mention here that as our Caregiving Today series continues here on AM 580, a couple of programs coming up in the series that might be of interest to this listener and others is that on January 13th here on the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk about housing options. And then coming up on the 26th of this month at 10 a.m., that's the Tuesday, November 26th, Respite and In-Home Services, in-home services, the topic of that program in the caregiving series. Let's go and talk with another listener, this one on line one on a cell phone. Good afternoon.
Yes, I had a question related to individuals that have had open heart surgery and whether there's a correlation and some memory loss there versus Alzheimer's, and if there's any implications to that.
I can say a few words. That is an interesting observation, and there have been several studies reported just recently looking at cognitive function before and after coronary artery bypass surgery. And there certainly is an indication that some cognitive functions are affected because of surgery or around surgery due to some factors. And so a memory impairment or some slowing of processing can occur after bypass surgery, but that's not Alzheimer's disease. Again, Alzheimer's disease is a degenerative disease of the brain with certain pathological features in the brain. Nevertheless, the cognitive similarities can be there, so somebody who may have coronary artery bypass surgery may suffer some cognitive slowing, some memory problems afterwards. That's like a dementia or a degree of cognitive impairment, but that's not necessarily Alzheimer's disease.
Okay, I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon. We're here at the end of the time. And before we go, though, I want to ask the two of you for a little bit more information about the memory loss support group that you're involved with, and that group for people who are suffering memory loss, and then also, do you have any information about a support group for caregivers?
Actually, the group for persons with memory loss was started specifically for them, and we didn't allow the caregivers in our group. We asked them to wait outside, and for about 8 weeks they did that, and then they said, we want our own group. So it's really at their own request. So our group runs simultaneously. We have the group for persons with memory loss, and then at the same time, their family member or loved one has a support group going on at the same location. We meet every other week on Tuesday afternoons at First United Methodist Church here in Champaign. We begin at 3. We go until 4:30, and sometimes people don't want to quit at 4:30, and because it's become a really meaningful experience for them to have a shared community where they know they're understood, where they know they're accepted, where other people can relate to what they're saying, and where they can feel free to talk about the things they want to talk about. So we do ask the family members to meet in a separate support group, and Jenny started out actually in that group before she started helping me, so she might be able to talk a little bit about that group.
I think as having been a member of both groups, I have the caregivers group is enormously helpful, I think, especially for me when we first came here. When my mom first came here, we joined the group pretty much immediately and learned a lot about doctors available in town and types of medication and types of medication that people were on and just experiencing talking about the kinds of things that different people were dealing with and how they were coping with it. It was an enormously effective experience.
Contact number or...
Actually, the best number is the Alzheimer's Association office number, and I don't have that memorized. I'm sorry. My office number, you're welcome to call, which is 333-3083, and a lot of people do just call my office directly. And Jenny, do you have a number that would be good, too?
Sure, you could call my office at 244-7535.
Okay, very good. And also for people dealing with dementia, I would recommend the Mayo Clinic on Alzheimer's disease. It's a great primer for folks. And the editor-in-chief, Dr. Ronald Peterson, has been one of our guests this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. Dr. Peterson, thank you so much.
Thank you, Celeste. I enjoyed it.
Dr. Bergner, Ginny, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.